Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the terminal meeting of the 5th Annual El Paso Jamboree. You know, we had one goal, and I don't know whether we've reached it or not when we had this jamboree, and that was to show people from outside the El Paso area that we were a friendly group here, and we hope that you have been given a genuinely, that's the wrong word, a genuine welcome. I could have sat down real quick then if I'd have followed Frank's advice yesterday. When you have that block, sit down. My name is Dick, and I am an alcoholic. That is for the benefit of those who cannot read the programs. We began this jamboree yesterday in a truly alcoholic way. The man who started out this program assumed that every alcoholic here could read. Now, this is not necessarily true, so he didn't introduce himself. One of the astonishing things that has come out of this jamboree is the fact that we have people here from 9 different states and 3 different countries, USA, Canada, and Mexico. There are some of you people who seem to be of a very sedentary nature, I noticed, after breakfast. You didn't get up and walk around and exercise a little bit. So right at this time, you're going to have to stand up when your area is called. You need this. Right at the last minute this morning, I was told that we have some people from Canada here. Would they kindly stand up? And let's give those people... We give them a warm southwestern welcome that will thaw them out. And I understand that we have some people from Chihuahua, Mexico. I know we did yesterday. What is Mexico? Stand up. She gives that the gringo accent now. They used to call that Colonia Dublan. Arizona. And that other territory outside the United States, California. Colorado. Colorado. In a state where I did a tremendous amount of drinking, the fact of the matter is my drinking career was born there, Kansas. And from the land of the chicory, Louisiana. Mississippi. Gotta hope he didn't get drunk. I know he was here yesterday. Montana. Nuevo Mexico. And I would like to see all those who are from outside the El Paso area in our great state of Tejas. Now, for the benefit of the El Pasoans who are coming last, they're in Texas, too, believe it or not. These are the people who have come here to share their experience, strength, and hope with us. God bless them. Now will the El Pasoans please arise. I think this is real wonderful. I understand that the registration is slightly above that of last year. And this is the way it should be. We should present a jamboree that makes people want to come back. And this is the way it is working. And you are most welcome, and we hope you return next year. I don't have any business being up here. I'll take care of you later. I received a phone call night before last, and when I raised the receiver, a voice said, "Dick, this is John." Well, now I know John. He doesn't have to tell me who he is. And there was this tone that arouses in an alcoholic who has been in AA for a year, instant suspicion. And I knew somehow or other that he was going to take about 400 words to give me the message that was in four words and two initials. And this is just exactly the way it works. 400 words later, I found out that you are the MC Sunday. It seemed that somehow the gentleman who originally was to be the MC Sunday made a great sacrifice and underwent major surgery in order to avoid this. Now, some of these fellows that have been in AA for some length of time can do amazing things. My sponsor, for example, who is my senior in AA and on this earth, originally was slated to be the chairman last night. And what did he do? He induced instant laryngitis. Even though he was going to announce an eye, ear, nose, and throat doctor. This is what we call an AA going to great lengths. But anyway, here I am. And before I go any further, well, anyway, when I got to the end of this telephone conversation, these boys who have been sober for 17 or 18 years can anesthetize you. And I knew the knife was coming, but I never felt it. And when I put the receiver down, I happened to glance down my belt line, and there the handle stuck out. Now, this is the way this program works. It sneaks up on you. Everything happens in the past tense. You people, I know, are just exactly like I am. You sit in a gathering like this, and you are unaware of the fact that things are just going like silk. And there has been a reason for this. You may or may have not noticed that during most of this jamboree, there has been a gentleman standing around the edges of the room from time to time, rarely sitting down, but nonetheless cocking a wary eye here and there in almost exactly the same manner as a Las Vegas floor boss. He has been most unobtrusive, and I know that he has received very little reward for his efforts vocally from other people. He said he was not going to name any names because always someone is left out, and with no intention of hurting anybody's feelings, I would like to say that the man most responsible for the smoothness with the way in which this conference has run has been due almost entirely to his gargantuan efforts. And he has done it with an ease that is, so it would appear to us, that is almost unbelievable. And I would like John to stand, and I would like you to acknowledge his fine efforts. This does not mean that there have not been a tremendous amount of people involved in this who have given freely of their time and their efforts. There have been many. On the other side of the picture, you were refreshed in a magnificent way Friday night by the Al-Anons. One woman undertook the tremendous chore, and she handled it beautifully, and we ate every damn thing that was in sight, as we're capable of doing. And I would like her to stand. Her name is Liz, and she is an Al-Anon. Now, the Al-Anons have a set of praying hands here, which are to be raffled off. I know that you want to hear the speaker. I know you're anticipating hearing him because he is a man with a great length of sobriety. He's about a 26-and-a-half-year model or something like that. He must have started drinking when he was about 12. You should look at him now. He shows no signs of the ravages of age. But anyway, we'll get this raffle over with, and then we'll get down to the meat of this business. Bertie, would you come up here and take care of this, please? We're doing this in order to avoid having to mail it after the meeting.
Don.
Okay, he's impartial. Number 154.
Ken from Richardson, Texas.
Ken from Richardson, Texas. How lucky can an alcoholic get? He gets free delivery. We are honored to have our terminal speaker, a man, like I told you, who must have begun drinking when he was 11 or 12, because he certainly doesn't look like he's over 36 or 37. I didn't actually have the honor of personally meeting this man until this morning, but I met him yesterday in spirit. I sat across the table from him in our GSR meeting. You can look in an alcoholic's eyes, you can hear his words, you can hear the tone of his voice, and you know him. Every talk that we have had has been wonderful at this jamboree, and I am quite sure that each and every one of us that came here with a need have already had it fulfilled. Like I say, I know this man just by looking in his eyes and just by hearing him speak. And knowing his length of sobriety, he has something on the ball. So let's find out what it is. I give you Cliff Dublin.
My name is Cliff W., and I've been pretty well brainwashed, so I'm going to identify myself Texas style. Mr. Dingling over there taught me on the way down. And I found it very wise when you're in Rome, you do as the Romans do. And quite often it's much more fun. I am an alcoholic. I have not, to see, by the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous, I have not found it necessary to take a drink of any kind or use pills, tranquilizers, or addictive drugs for more than 26-and-a-half years. Did I say that right?
All right, well...
Hi. Oh, did I forget that? That's California. Hi. Now, I say this without any feeling of anything personally achieved, believe me. I said out of the deepest gratitude to Alcoholics Anonymous. And even more important, to let anybody know here that wants to know it, that this program of Alcoholics Anonymous really works if you want to quit drinking. I'd like also, while I'm thinking of it, to pay my deepest thanks and warmest congratulations to John and the Jamboree Committee for putting such a wonderful affair together. Now, I've been involved in these things, and they take an awful lot of detailed chore work. You come here and everything's arranged, but you can't imagine the amount of work that goes together to make these things possible. But even then, to make it successful, it all revolves around the people that attend. I don't think I've ever attended an AA function anywhere where this intangible but unmistakable spirit of AA has been so apparent as it here. You can just almost cut it with a knife. And it's a remarkable thing. It's the greatest thing that we can show this newcomer, the spirit of AA. And I'm very grateful that you asked me to participate. And I do have to say something about John. You got a very fine program chairman. And he's very careful. He came up to Los Angeles, and I guess somebody recommended me. Must have been one of my best friends. But he was cautious enough that he came out to Whittier and attended a meeting with me to check me out where I was speaking. But you know, I damn near blew the whole thing because I got lost. In my own hometown, I couldn't find the meeting place. I thought, boy, I guess I'm 86th out of Texas. But John, in his nice way, says, well, he says, you know, I just feel that I'm at the right place at the right time. But, you know, I think he still was a little worried because when he routed me down here, he routed me down with this crazy doctor. I guess he figured if I couldn't find a meeting in my own hometown, I'd never find El Paso. I'd like also to pay a very warm and special welcome to any of you that are new or fairly new to our fellowship. And I'd like to make it ever so clear, my role in being here today, I am not an expert on alcoholism, regardless of years. I am not a preacher. I'm not a teacher. I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm not even a speaker. I like to think of myself as an experienced sharer. I'm here today to share with you a miraculous experience. In doing so, I keep myself sober, and I sincerely hope that somebody else has helped besides me in listening to this experience. I think AA is the greatest thing on God's green earth. And I think members of Alcoholics Anonymous are the luckiest people on earth. And you know why? Father Gene touched upon it yesterday. This is a very troubled world we live in, isn't it? There's an awful lot of sick people who are walking the streets today, mentally and emotionally sick. They're filled with fear and frustrations. Somehow they sense that their life has had no meaning or purpose. And they are truly sick, but they don't know what is wrong with them. Thank God we know what's wrong with us, don't we? It has a name. It has symptoms. And those symptoms can be identified. And also then we have a solution to our problem, don't we? We not only have this solution, but we have a society or a fellowship of our own kind of people, where we can work out this our problems with their moral support. And also have us around us an overwhelming amount of testimony that this thing works. Just look here today. Any new guy, this is a demonstration of strength. It's a testimony that this thing works. Thank God AA doesn't deal in theology or theory. AA is evidential. We deal with the experience. These Bible students probably read in the Bible about the two apostles. They came upon this incurable lame man, and they cured him immediately. The ecclesiastics of the day, I guess they were the eggheads, happened to see it. And they were quite amazed, so they asked these two apostles, well, how did this come about? The apostles said this was the name of Christ. Well, these eggheads, they saw the lame man that had been cured. What could they say? They could quarrel with the theory or the method, but they couldn't quarrel with the evidence or the experience. You know, you hear quite often, well, doctors will say this isn't a sickness or it isn't a disease. What do we care? We know that 500,000 people in God's green earth who were hopelessly gone are walking the streets today because they came to believe it was a sickness. So we care whether it's a disease or not. You read quite often now in the papers about God is dead. Well, God is dead, if you want him to be. I found out God is just about whatever you want him to be. And God will never invade your personal privacy if you don't want him. But you can't tell 500,000 AAs that God is dead when this has been coming to believe in him, or a greater power has brought them out of this dark world they lived in. Too much evidence to the contrary. Bill has quite often said that AA is not only a moral program, it's spiritually centered. Now, sooner or later, every member of AA, or alcoholic approaching AA, comes to believe in and make use of a power greater than himself. And those that don't come to believe this eventually drink again or seldom have permanent recovery. God, as we understand them, as we understand him, is then the very firm spiritual foundation upon which our society rests. And I think every AA member that's been around very long would agree to that. However, we have found through the years that many alcoholics make a tremendous issue of the spiritual part of the program. And they put up hurdles and mountains of objections that shouldn't be there at all. And I know in the early days, in Los Angeles, Bill used to call us a godless group because we never mentioned anything about spirituality or God. Our numbers were so darn few, we just couldn't spare any. And we knew if we mentioned God, we'd probably drive him away. Today, I would like to share with you a chapter out of my AA life of recovery. Probably the most important period of my entire life. The first 2 years of my AA life were, it took me 2 years to come to believe. I can't say they were necessarily happy years. They were years of tremendous work, and I think you could say if I was happy, it would be more like I had frantic serenity. But they're the 2 years of my life I never want to forget. But you know, for a long time, after that time, this happened, I never talked about it. If I did talk about it, it was with apology. But one time, something happened in Whittier that made me realize... Are they coming through? That is something I should share. It was brought very forcibly home to me.
Yes, David, that's my idea.
I went to the meeting one night in Whittier, and one of our newer people come up to me before the meeting and said, "Cliff, you've been around quite a while. I want to ask you something. I'm troubled." He said, "I was a terrible alcoholic, and alcohol just completely destroyed my life. And about a month ago, I joined AA." And he says, "I love it. I'm enthralled with it. The atmosphere, the laughter, the warmth that you people have shown me. I'd rather join you and have what you have more than anything else in the world." So he said, "A couple of weeks ago, I bought a book. The big book, and I've been reading it day and night, and it's a wonderful book. But Cliff, I'm intelligent enough to know that the crux of your recovery stems from coming to believe in a power greater than yourself. It's spiritual, it's God. Cliff, I would like to believe that. I'd like to have faith. I'd like to have all these things, but you know that my people were Baptists, hard shell Baptists. And as a boy, they taught me to hate and fear God. And I know it's childish, but I still have this feeling, and I don't think I could ever come to believe in this thing. Now, Cliff, and give it to me straight. Am I going to be one of the 25% of the people approaching you that can never make this program?" Well, just then, the chairman called the meeting to order. Now, Whittier is my home group, and they never let me talk, which is the way it should be. But I guess God took a hand this night, because the chairman got up and he said, "Well, the speaker didn't show up, and there's an old timer there that I think would probably like to talk if we let him. Cliff, you got anything to say?" I says, "Hell yes," and I got up and I really dashed to the podium, because I had something to say. And I told this newfound friend, I said, "You have nothing to worry about, not a thing." I said, "The condition of our membership is not believing in anything. The only requirement to become a member of AA is the desire to quit drinking. You have that." I said, "I would bet over half of our membership are atheists or agnostic or antagonistic like you, or have had faith and lost it. And through the years, we have found that the people recovering on this program that are atheists and agnostic have the same chance of recovery as those that have faith. Their chances are equal if they have this tremendous desire to quit drinking." And I said, "You know, you told my story, or started to, about your childhood. Let me tell you something. I was the son of a preacher back in Kansas. Liberal Kansas. I don't know if you people from Kansas are aware of it or know where it is, but it's not a very big place. And my dad was a town preacher. And as a little boy, Sunday, today, was the worst day in my life. It was my day of rebellion, because I had to go to church and Sunday school and Christian Endeavor and all these things, as a good example for all the other little boys. And I hated it. I loved my father, but I hated the things they were talking about. I'd go to Sunday school, and some hard-faced gal would tell me I had to love Jesus and love God. How could I do that? I couldn't love God. He was the guy upstairs with the long beard that was sending little boys to hell for doing things wrong. This was a tough world. How could I love that man? And Jesus, a sad-faced man. It had a picture on the wall with a red beard. No muscle. I could love Daniel, who fought the lions, or David, who slew Goliath. But Jesus, no. I mean, this is terrible. I know, because Christ wasn't like that. He was the greatest man that ever lived. A man, a strong, virile man. A great leader. But I wasn't taught that. And after I left For three years, as long as I lived at home, I went to church, I went to the funerals and all the weddings. Weddings and funerals to me were the same. They smelled the same and everybody cried. So I ate them both. But I developed through the years not only this fear, I developed a very deep-seated resentment and even a contempt for spiritual terms, church people, or anybody else. It's worse than being atheistic, I think. It's an antagonism so deep that it's hard to explain. But in 1940, I came face to face with a decision that God is or God isn't. Just the year before, our family doctor, who we loved and trusted very much, had told my wife, Dorothy, he said, "Mrs. Walker, I have never seen a drinker like your husband ever get well. And I've been treating them for years. There's a certain type of people, when they drink, they just lose complete control. And I've never had success in helping such people. And your husband, his brain damage and everything else has deteriorated to the point. I would recommend very highly that you have him completely and totally confined. Or I'm afraid your husband will destroy himself or go mad within a year." But I was a very fortunate guy. I had a wife who in 1939 knew that I was sick. Dorothy, this is unique to me. Dorothy knew I was sick. One day, and she was always trying to help me find a way out. After I joined AA, one time I asked her, I said, "Dorothy, how did you know that I was sick?" "Well, Cliff, you know, I'll tell you why. Because you were always such a fine person when you were sober. And then you'd go on these terrible binges, and you weren't yourself at all, and you did these horrible things. And one time, after you had sobered up after a terrible binge, the first time I ever saw you cry when you were sober, you broke down and cried. And somehow I sensed that you were in the grip of something beyond your own control." And she had seen the same thing happen to her wonderful father who had shot himself as an alcoholic. So she said, "I determined I was going to stick by you and do anything I could to find this way out for you." And Dorothy did. My God, we tried everything. We tried the geographical cure. I'd say, "Dorothy, let's move out of this neighborhood. These guys in these bars, they lay me down on the barroom floor and pour that whiskey down my throat." Oh, we'd move out to another neighborhood and we'd meet the same guys and they'd do the same thing. I'd say, "Honey, why don't you let me bring my booze home? And you drink with me and I can control it." Well, the only thing happened there, I damn near made an alcoholic out of Dorothy. One day, Dorothy gave me a book my neighbor had given her. It was called Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill. You know, I stayed sober about 6 months on that book. Instead of using it for growing rich, I used it for quitting drinking. And it worked for a while. But somehow, Dorothy... But I do want to mention this. I love Al-Anon. I think it's just as great. To me, an Al-Anon is an AA. My God, they suffered so much worse than we did. I know my wife hurt much more than I could always be numbed, but my wife suffered far more than I did. And I think Al-Anon people are... I just can't understand them, really. It's beyond my understanding how these people could have stuck with us so long. I could have never stuck with Dorothy. You know, if it hadn't been for Ann Smith and Lois Wilson and all the Al-Anons, the wives of the original members, there could have never been an AA. Thank God for them. And If anybody wants to fight after, fight at 155. And I've never won a fight in my life. But anyway, Dorothy found AA for me in early 1940. Impossible. You know who's my sponsor, really? Beatrice Fairfax. Dorothy read an article about the two groups in Akron and New York called Alcoholics Anonymous, a new cure for drunkards. And she wrote them, wrote Beatrice. Beatrice gave her the name of a man that went to a certain church in New York. That's all she had. So Dorothy wrote to that man. It just happened that Bell and Ruth Hawk had opened up an office on VC Street, and he knew it. So he turned the letter over to them. And I often thought, I wonder what had ever happened to me if Dr. Bob and Bill and the early founders hadn't thought enough of me to take the risk of printing a book and opening up an office and getting publicity. Where would I be today? If they hadn't cared enough, I'd be dead. Because just by the grace of God, this thing come. You know where that letter finally wound up? In a woman's waste paper basket in Los Angeles. The woman brought it out and called me and wanted me to help her start AA. And this is a non-alcoholic woman who just worked her head off to start an AA in California, or Los Angeles. And when she called me, I didn't need AA. I'd been sober 2 or 3 weeks. The next thing I heard was of AA was a guy from Denver who'd come all the way to California to find AA. And he went up to see this gal, and she was leaving for Honolulu. Everybody was drunk, and he said, well, I need some work. Is there anybody I could call on? She says, yeah, there's a waste paper basket full of them. And there was Dorothy's letter. And this guy called on me. And when he called on me, I was just getting over a hell of a binge and was receptive. So I go to my first meeting at the Cecil Hotel on Skid Row, which I think is the first open meeting we had in Los Angeles. And Mort opened the meeting. It started at 10:30 in the evening. Because Mort had the only car, I think, and he was out gathering up all the drunks. At 10:30 we started, and this guy says, you know, I've never been to an AA meeting. I don't know what the format is. But he said, one morning I woke up from a terrible binge in a Palm Springs hotel. And I was looking for the bottle I hid the night before. And I run across this book, and he picked up the big book. I don't know where I got it either. But you know, I opened up that book and started to read. I read all that day, all that night, and all the next day. With the world's worst hangover, I never left that room. And I knew that this was it. He said, that was 3 months ago, and I haven't had a drink since. He said, I'm convinced that the principles incorporated in this book will bring sobriety on an all-time basis to any alcoholic in the world that really wants to quit drinking. So he opens up the book, the old book, to page 71. He reads the preamble, the 12 steps, and the paragraph afterwards. And that has become one of the greatest traditions in Southern California. And I think it's great. One reason it says, in a sense, this is a thing of principles and not personalities. Moore says, I know nothing about it. If you want the answers, go to the book. Anyway, after that first meeting, Mort continued to start every meeting by reading the 12 steps. Well, finally, I rebelled. One day I asked Mort, I said, why in the heck do you read these damn 12 steps every meeting? Well, Mort says, why shouldn't we? I said, well, they're repetitious. Once you heard them, you heard them. And I said, besides, they're not pertinent to my problem. He said, what is your problem? That's why I just drink too much. My wife tells me when I'm sober, I'm a heck of a nice guy. And I said, there's nothing in there about quitting drinking. It says something about alcohol in the first and the last step. I said, and all that other stuff, that God business, that moral stuff, I've had that all my life. My dad was a preacher's son. If God would work with me, I wouldn't have been here. Well, Mort was new. He didn't know what to tell me. But I'll tell you new people something. This is pretty good advice if you want to take it. But in AA, when you want advice, you'll always get it. Most of us can give it by the bushel and take it by the peck. But be careful who you take the advice from. Because the guy come up after the meeting and gave me some advice that damn near killed me. He said, Cliff, you don't have to worry about all those 12 steps. Just take one step you like and that'll keep you sober. And I found out later this guy had only been, he'd been to less meetings than I had. But I liked the advice. But I said, well, I'm a gambler. I like the percentages on my side, so I'll take two steps. I took the first and the last, I thought. And I became a two-stepper for a while, and I stayed sober for a while, which wasn't unusual for me. I always stayed sober after a bad binge. But I blamed it on the two steps I was taking. But, of course, the inevitable happened. I finally got taken drunk. And not only got taken drunk, I went on the worst drunk of my entire career. It was horrible. I don't know about the rest of you, but one of the things that made it bad, you know, in AA, when you come in, you learn so much more about drinking you never heard before. These drunks are a very ingenious bunch of people. They told me where to hide bottles that I'd never thought of. Where to get whiskey. How to con your wife? Where to get money? One guy, he got up one night, he said, you know, every time I start on a binge, I always put some money in an envelope and mail it to myself. So two or three days later, when I really need it, here comes this money in the mail. Well, I tried it, and it sure works. But the worst part about it was the demoralization. We had had such high hopes for AA, believe me. Dorothy had, and so had I. And we were completely demoralized. And what made it worse, when I attended this first meeting down to Cecil, I met a guy from Phoenix, Arizona, named Gordon. Gordon and his wife had come all the way from Phoenix to Los Angeles to find AA. But Gordon, I think, had made a very logical mistake before he attended the meeting. He told his wife, he says, Myrtle, if I'm going to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, I better get drunk so they'll know I'm an alcoholic. But Gordon overdid it. He passed out cold at his first meeting. Never heard a word. I think I drove him home. But the next meeting, Gordon came back sober. And Dorothy and I became quite friendly with him. And finally, Gordon and Merle had to come back to Phoenix. But right in the midst of this binge, the worst of my life, Merle starts writing Dorothy the most glowing letters in the world. They were terrible. And they go something like this. Gordon is doing wonderfully well. He's not only staying sober, but he has changed. The kids got over their fear of him. The neighbors are speaking to us again. He's got a good job. He's holding his head up when he walks the streets today. Well, you can imagine the impact of these letters on the Walker household, which is in complete shambles. Well, you know, I just couldn't get over this. I have kind of an obsessive, compulsive type of personality. I get fixed ideas, you know. At that time, I was holding on very precariously to a milkman's job. But anyway, I got to thinking about Gordon, and here's the way my alcoholic thinking went. How in the devil does this guy stay sober over in Phoenix? They don't even have an AA group over there. We have one here, and I'm staying drunk. Now remember, just a little skinny, scrawny guy. He wore glasses. I didn't. That's intelligent. I knew I was stronger, smarter, and better looking than he was. And yet, he is staying sober. Well, the inevitable happened. One day I disappeared. The milk truck disappeared. The money disappeared. And you know where...